The Texas Hill Country is one of the most beautiful places on earth. In this podcast, recent Hill Country resident Tom Fox visits with the people and organizations that make this one of the most unique areas of Texas. Join Tom as he explores the people, places, and their activities of the Texas Hill Country.
This is Tom Fox. Welcome to the inaugural episode of the Hill Country podcast. I fell in love with the Texas Hill Country when I came to Camp Stewart for Boys in the late 60s. I thought it was the most beautiful place on earth I had ever seen. The Hill Country is just that. Rolling hills as low as 500 feet and as high as 3,000 feet. Rock, granite, conifers, firs, and the most beautiful landscape, bluffs, and rivers I've ever seen. I'm going to explore the people, places, and things of the Hill Country in this podcast. Because I moved to the Hill Country from my Camp Stewart experience, I wanted to have as my first guest, Kathy Ragsdale. Kathy and her late husband, Cy Ragsdale, purchased Camp Stewart in 1967. And I attended Camp Stewart that year. Kathy talks about how they came to purchase Camp Stewart. It had been Cy Ragsdale's lifelong dream to purchase it after he attended as a camper in the 1930s. He and Kathy purchased it from Uncle Bill and Aunt Kate, and then the family, the Ragsdale family, still runs Camp Stewart today. We talk about what it was like for Kathy and Cy in the early days, how camping has evolved over the years, what camping is like now for the Ragsdale family and the experience of the campers, and Camp Stewart is coming up on its 100th anniversary in 2023. So we talk about camping into the future. This is a passion project for me. I absolutely love where I live, and hope I can communicate my love of the Hill Country to you in this podcast series. Thanks so much for listening. Well, hello everyone, and welcome to the inaugural edition of the Hill Country podcast. Today I'm with Kathy Ragsdale, one of the owners of Camp Stewart, which is the reason I'm in the Hill Country, because of my camping experience here. So Kathy, I can't thank you enough for taking the time to visit with me today.
Oh, it's fun. You want to talk about Camp Stewart, that's my favorite thing to talk about.
Well, what are the origins of Camp Stewart? When did it start, and who founded it?
Coach Doc Stewart founded it. Now, Doc was his nickname, but he was also a medical doctor. But when he founded Camp Stewart in 1924, he was the head athletic director, football coach, and basketball coach at the University of Texas in Austin. He's also the one credited with getting the funds to build the current Darrell Royal Stadium. So, 1924, he started it.
And when did you and your deceased husband, Cy, come on board as the purchasers of Camp Stewart?
Okay. It's Cy, you may or may not know, was a camper here in 1936. And we signed the papers to start buying Camp Stewart on our first anniversary in 1966, August the 14th, 1966. We were flooded in at Riverbend Lodge, which Uncle Bill James also owned for 3 days because there was a flood that weekend. So it was an adventuresome start. And we are here because when Cy was his first year as a camper was 1935 at Rio Vista. Then Rio Vista closed and was closed for 5 years. And he came to Stewart. He got his Red Cross life-saving badge in the senior pool here at Stewart. He said Stewart was where he really learned to sit a horse because they had a 3-day horseback ride. In those days, a camp term was 8 weeks. So in 8 weeks, you really could develop real skills. So it was his passion for camping developed from the first time he came to camp as a little boy. That's the reason we're here.
And that passion stayed with Cy. He served our country in World War II, and you told me that he even kept that passion that helped keep him sane during the war. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure.
He always said that he kept a notebook with him, and in the foxholes, when everybody else was worrying, he was writing down notes about if he were ever fortunate enough to own his own camp, things that he would like to try there. He kept names of people that he met throughout the war that he thought would make great counselors and would contribute a lot to the development of boys as they grew into manhood. So he stayed perfectly sane. He never would talk about his experiences in the war.
You mentioned Uncle Bill. Could you tell us Uncle Bill's role taking over after Doc Stewart and then how you all came to purchase the camp from Uncle Bill and I believe Aunt Kate?
And Aunt Kate, that's right, Tom. Well, Uncle Bill was Doc Stewart's program director probably in about 1927 or 28. I'm not sure which was his first year as program director, but he was the program director in 1929. And Doc Stewart was such an entrepreneur. I said he started Camp Stewart in 1924, but in 1926, he built Camp Mystic as Camp Stewart for Girls over on the South Fork. And in 1928, he built Heart of the Hills Lodges, which is now Heart of the Hills Camp that we own as a camp for girls, as a place for the parents to stay. And it was one of the first air-conditioned places in the Hill Country and was very much a resort and popular honeymoon spot for young couples. So Uncle Bill was on Doc Stewart's staff, and I guess Doc Stewart knew Uncle Bill through his role as a line coach at the university for Doc Stewart. Doc Stewart was killed in a hunting accident in the fall of 1929. After his death, Uncle Bill and his wife, Aunt Kate, and those are honorary titles. That's what all campers and former campers and everybody that knew them called them, started purchasing Camp Stewart from Doc Stewart's widow. And they began operating it. And, of course, they owned it when Cy was a camper here in 1936. Unbeknownst to me, when we started dating, Cy had tried to buy Stewart several years before on the suggestion from the late Doris Johnson, who owned Waldemar and directed it for so many years. And at the last minute, it had fallen through. And he always said he didn't tell me about it because he didn't think there was any chance of it ever coming to ever happening. So I grew up in the country on a ranch behind 3 gates and a railroad track and no running water. I didn't intend to ever live in the country again. So what happened? That's exactly what happened. Never think never. So we moved down in January of 67 after took a while to sell the house in Denton, change schools for the children, all of the things that have to be done. And then we moved January of 67, and the rest is history.
So what was it like to move? I won't say Denton was a big city in 1967, but it's certainly bigger than Hunt, Texas, and certainly a little more probably cosmopolitan than Camp Stewart was at the time. What was that like for you? But now that I know you grew up on a ranch, maybe it was like something you were used to or really not?
Oh, it was easy to adapt. I had gone to Denton, to Texas Woman's University, and when and I met, I was working for the university, actually for the foundation of the university. My job was to visit high schools throughout the state and try to do that hard sell of talking teenage girls into going to an all-girls school. But it was something I loved and believed in. So I thought when Si and I married, he was the executive chamber director, Denton, that I was going to live close to Neiman's and Casa Manana, Joe Garcia's Mexican food in Fort Worth and all those wonderful things. And we moved to Camp Stewart, where there was running water and there was electricity, except when it didn't work. But the water turned everything you owned orange. I don't think that was by design. I think it was minerals. And it was long distance to call Kerrville. And the local phone exchange cut you off. Well, they gave you a warning at 3 minutes. You got cut off at 5 minutes. Inez Harrison, the longtime wonderful director at Camp Mystic, and I never finished a conversation, because how do you finish conversation in 3 minutes? Impossible.
So my first year as a camper here was in 1967, and I had second year in 1968. And frankly, we always thought of you as the camp mom.
That was my role. Our first summer here, Si handed me the checkbook and said, "You're in charge of all financials." And I quickly learned that my job was to do all the things he didn't want to do. He was an idea man and a showman, but he needed a sergeant. And one of the stories he used to tell the counselors was that he learned in OCS school was, how do you erect a flagpole in the middle of the Sahara Desert? So everybody comes up with all of this, these fancy answers. And the answer was, you say, "Sergeant, get that flagpole erected and you leave. You don't attempt to tell them how to do it." And that was kind of assigned my role. He was the general, I was the sergeant, and so he was out and about meeting people and doing things, and I was in the office, the same office that I've been in since 1967, but it looks a little different now. That first, those first few years, there were three of us in it, and now we're sitting in an office that we built many years later, or in addition to the original office that was Si's office until he retired. So it's grown like everything else at Stewart, but we've tried to keep the basics. And when you drove in, didn't it look the same to you? As you said, it looked smaller than it did when you were a little boy. And that's what most people say when they come back. We took all the water pipes that ran on top of the ground and buried them. I used to tease Si in those first, hard first few years that the sun was shining on Joy Bluff into his eyes so much that he couldn't see in what bad physical condition the physical plant was in. He just saw it in his mind's eye as a little boy. And it really was still great for little boys, but people tripped on water pipes that were above ground. Uncle Bill's caretaker told Si, but Mr. Ragsdale, it's so much easier to repair if you don't bury them pipes. It took a little education to get all the pipes buried and the electrical lines raised and buried. So we, through the years, tried to keep the feel and just make it better.
Let me ask you a few questions about those early years from my perspective, around the counselors. As I recall, each cabin had a couple of counselors. One was a college guy, and then one was a little bit older man who may have been involved in other activities. The college guy tended to stay with us most of the day, if I remembered that right. How did you go about getting your counselors out here?
Oh, the hiring counselors is still one of the hardest aspects of camping. But in those days, now we have to have 3 counselors per cabin. In those days, you're right, we had 2. But the reason the younger guys seem to stay with you all the time is Si had read about a cabin leader system while he was in the war that a camp director on the East Coast had developed, where one counselor always stayed with the campers in his cabin and became the expert on them. He went with them to all activities. The other counselor, and he could have been younger, he could have been older, was an activity counselor, and he taught one of the activities. And so that's the way that happened. But we, those first couple of years, drew heavily on the people that had been counselors for Uncle Bill. Now, a lot of them, especially a lot of old-timers, would not transfer when some of them had wanted to buy the camp from Uncle Bill, and when instead he sold it to this new young fella, they didn't like that very much. But a lot of them, like Travis Lipscomb, who was responsible for you coming, their allegiance was to camp and to the boys it served, not to whomever was the director. And I think that's one of the things that makes camp so great, is people who really love it, their allegiance is to the camp, not to a person. But to get new blood, Si leaned heavily on his fraternity connections, just as he had done when right after the war he was the boys' camp director at Camp Fern in Marshall. He always said he would start trying to recruit them as counselors in the fall at the end of the summer, and they were always going to Europe or something. Then in January, they were thinking, well, maybe I'm going to get an internship. And by about February or March, they were ready to come to camp. So it's a involved undertaking that requires one to develop patience. But we get counselors from all over the world now, through Camp America, some through camp leaders, mostly word of mouth, even for those. And former campers get outstanding counselors from former campers.
You mentioned activities, and I recall a wide variety of activities, obviously physical activities, baseball, soccer, football, tennis, other skills such as archery, shooting, learning how to shoot a rifle, horseback riding, camping were big parts of it. But we had crafts, and we had things even like theater.
Yes.
So
you had Fred Poole.
So how did we, or how did you all decide on the types of activities, and have those really changed over the years for you?
Those have not changed much. We've added some, and the boys' interest, like the interest in soccer has grown, and it's decreased in baseball. last summer there was a little more interest in baseball, but everything kind of goes in cycles, and you have to watch the cycles to keep up with what they're doing. But we've added things like the pedal carts, and the pedal carts look like an innocuous activity and that they're not learning anything, but they are the greatest activity for a couch potato. Because you've got some children that do not like physical activity, but getting in that little car and getting to pedal all around camp, which uses lots of energy and leg muscles, thrills them to death. And they'll do that for hours. Whereas if you told them to go play basketball or play tennis, they really don't like that.
So Camp Stewart's website has a blog, and I was really intrigued by one of your blogs, which was about what I would call homesickness, and now it's called separation anxiety. And I think that's been around as long as kids have been around.
It has.
But what intrigued me about your blog was not so much how you treat it, but the effects, if one goes through it as a child, it really can help you later in life. So first of all, how do you deal with the homesickness, not just from the campers, but from the parents?
The separation anxiety for parents is the worst. But my initial knowledge of how to deal with homesickness and the value of it for campers came in 1966 when we bought camp. One of my friends told me, said a child, her daughter had gone to camp for several years and was in college now. She said, Nancy Jane is the only one of all of her friends who finished her freshman year and didn't come home. She's the only one who went to camp. The others dropped out because they were so homesick. Rollins Olmsted told me the same thing about his first year at West Point. He said, all of the ones that left, no one had been to camp. And he wrote a letter and said, you know, camp has made all the difference in the world in my ability to adjust. But we still deal with it much the same way as Cy says we talk them to death. We love on them and explain this too shall pass. The parents always, I never have told a mother this, but I always think of what Betty Noe from New Orleans told her daughter once. She said, Claire, gut it up. You're sticking it out. The worst thing parents can do is say, if you don't like it, I'll come get it, because that sets you up for failure. Because once you stop doing something, it is so much easier the next time to take the easy way out. And so we try to always tell parents and the camper, you need to finish what you started. Finish what you started. You may not want to do it again, but don't quit.
In my second year, I don't know why I still remember this, but there was a fellow from England who came. And I had never actually met an English person before. I grew up in a little town in Central Texas. And I always wondered, one, how did he find out about Camp Stewart to come? But how on earth did he get here?
Well, he flew by himself to San Antonio, Texas, and we picked him up. And then he was an interesting story, because he was an American. His daddy and his uncles had all been campers. And his father worked for, I believe it was Swift at that time in England. And he worked there. Franklin not only came that year in 68, he came for several years. And then he came back as a counselor. And then after, maybe he was in high school, his family moved back to the States, to Austin, and his dad started a meat processing company in Austin and called Lone Star Meats. And for years, the camp bought all of its meat from Franklin and his dad. Franklin and his son, Edward, are running the company now. And Edward also was a camper, and Edward earned his chief. I can't tell you what number chief he was, but he got his chief.
What has really changed for the camping experience or for Camp Stewart over these years now as we move into a new century?
I think the biggest thing that has changed is the parents. They're much more hands-on. In the camping world, we call them helicopter parents because they want to micromanage, where our philosophy is that the children are in a protected environment. This is their opportunity to make mistakes, to learn new skills. I can remember when one of the counselors came to me several years ago and he said, "Kathy, I need to talk to you about so-and-so. He just got into an altercation with somebody." And I looked at him and I said, "That's the most wonderful thing I've ever heard," because this child had been expected to be perfect all of his life. And it was his first opportunity to stand up for himself and to learn who he was. We do not condone altercations, but in some instances, that's good. And you just have to recognize that basically little boys are still the same. They're not as tough as they were, and they mature later than in many of the practical ways than they did 55 years ago. I have a hard time realizing I just finished my 55th summer here. But they're basically still the same. They're wonderful. They're honest. They tell it the way they see it. They're great.
So the Ragsdale family still runs Camp Stewart. You've stepped back from the day-to-day operations. Tell us about who's running it now for the Ragsdale family.
Jeeper runs it now. He was born here just before you came in 1968. Actually, he was born in Kerrville in the hospital, but he was born May of 68. And so he literally grew up here. Sinai did not expect or demand that he take over the camp when he and Jane started approaching, let's say adulthood, but, you know, mid-20s. We sat down with each of them separately and said, "Now, what do you want to do? Because what you want to do determines how we proceed with estate planning," because there were at that time two other siblings, neither of whom were involved in the camps, and we needed to know in what direction, because camping's hard. I always called it a jealous mistress. And you are on call 9 days a week, 30 hours a day when camp's in session. And you have the responsibility for all those many little boys. It's not just the campers, it's the counselors. It's like a small city. You've got the water, you've got the sewerage, you've got the food service, you've got the laundry. You know, it's everything. It's not just the canteen and going to activities. And so each of them, each Jane and Jeeper came back and said, "This is what we want to do." I remember Jeeper's comment because we were in Monterrey, Mexico at a horse show. And at that time Jeeper was still competing, and he was at Olympic level, and he had to make the decision whether he turned pro and pursued a jumping career or whether he came back and worked at camp. And he said, I remember his words exactly, "Why would I want to do anything but camp? It is the best of all worlds." He said, "Now, if I won the lottery, I'd hire a really good person to recruit during the winter months and do all that. And I'd go to Europe and jump, but I'd be there in the summer to run camp." So he has a passion for it. And hopefully, Cy the Fourth, his son, who's now 13, will have a passion. But that's an unknown, and you can't dictate what they're going to do, because if their passion is not for camping, it's not going to be successful.
So we started out our podcast, you telling us about the founding of Camp Stewart, and that really brings me to our last topic, which is you've got a big birthday party coming up in 2024. Could you tell us what that is and maybe preview what you might be able to do?
Well, we're still thinking about what we'll do. 24 is 100 years, but in the camping world, we really count summers. So 2023 is our 100th summer. And so we've been, for the last 2 years, brainstorming on ideas and an emblem to commemorate 100 summers. We always say Camp Stewart is the oldest continually operated private camp in the Southwest, because it has operated continuously throughout the Depression, throughout the polio, throughout the wars. Uncle Bill was innovative during the war with shortages. He planted a big garden, and the older boys, he would have work so many hours a day. And you could ask him before his death about, "Well, Uncle Bill, so-and-so said he was a work boy and worked in the garden." He said, "Kathy, he didn't work. He was supposed to, but I knew when he was supposed to be working in the garden, right where to go find him asleep in the cornrows." And so they, you know, but he did that. He put in a dairy. There was the Stewart Dairy. And so you just have to be innovative. And I'm not sure what all we do. We'll do something probably in 23 and 24, because one's years, one's summers. But to me, the summer's the big thing.
So as we also started out, I said that the thing that I remembered was the Hill Country. And obviously, Joy Bluff is number one, the water. But I didn't just fall in love with the Hill Country being on Camp Stewart. We went on camping trips. We went and looked at archaeological sites. We drove in a lot of different places in the Hill Country. We even had a Kerrville night, so that I got to see the Hill Country, and that's what I fell in love with. Is that the kind of thing you hear from people?
Yes. Yeah.
So, unfortunately, we're near the end of our time, Kathy, but if anyone wanted to find out more about Camp Stewart, what would be the best place they could go?
Oh, go to www.campstewart.com or pick up the telephone and call 830-238-4670. If a person in the Camp Stewart office doesn't answer it, it will be a person at an answering service that has answered Stewart's nighttime calls for almost 30 years. So that's the way. And we hope they will. We try to have the very best camping program possible for little boys so that they can develop into being the best they can be. Stuart's motto when we got here was, don't wait to be a man to be great. Be a great boy. And then a friend a few years ago sent me one that says, build better boys. Don't fix broken men. And I thought, you know, if we do our job, we help boys develop into the best they can be. And that's the goal. Help each little boy be the best he can be, whatever that is.
Well, Kathy, I wanted to thank you again, and hopefully I'll be able to continue this conversation with you into 23, 24, and beyond.
Oh, that'd be fun. I hope I'm still here to do it.
All right, thank you, Tom.
This is Tom Fox again. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of the Hill Country Podcast. We're going to link to Camp Stuart in the show notes. If you have young boys, I can't tell you enough what a great experience Camp Stuart is in 2021, and it will be as it was in 1967. So thanks again, and I hope you'll join me again for my next episode in the Hill Country Podcast, where I explore the people, places, and things that make the Hill Country the most unique part of the great state of Texas.